Welcome to the Sum of It All, Bad at Math podcast. I'm Audrey Mendeville, along with my colleague Mark Alcorn from the San Diego County Office of Education. This season, we're exploring the book, Bad at Math, Dismantling Harmful Beliefs That Hinder Equitable Mathematics Education by Lydia Gonzalez. Transcripts for our podcasts are always available for you in the episode notes on your favorite platform. This week, we are chatting about Chapter 1, What Does It Mean to Be Good at Math? The chapter starts right off with this, Mark, and I love this. She dives in and says, we've developed as a society a belief that being good at mathematics means being able to complete numeric computations in one's head both quickly and accurately, and making speed and computational skills essential. What'd you think?
Well, the first thing I thought of when I read that, Audrey, is, wow, things have not changed that much, right?
Yeah.
I'm thinking like, you know, if I went back in my time machine to the beginning of my career and I was in conversations with colleagues and with parents and community members and everybody, and there was a lot of frustration about students not being fast enough with their computation. And I know that I've been in recent conversations around that still. So it's really interesting how that belief around what mathematics is to many people has not changed very much in terms of like a major impact of change. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, for sure. You know, there's this other belief that she mentions right off the bat that says to be good at math, you should be able to work through mathematical problems using previously memorized algorithms, procedures without additional aids such as textbooks or calculators. And that's definitely one of those predominant views you see in secondary mathematics classrooms. Like, we're not going to give you a calculator. You should know how to do it already. And we're not going to, you know, we're going to expect that you memorize the algorithms. We're not going to let you know what those are. We're not going to let you look them up. You got to have it all in your head. So it's super interesting to think about how we perpetuate these beliefs. And, you know, I think the author is really pushing on us to say, like, we're going to need to interrupt them if we're going to be able to tap into the brilliance of all of our students. Which makes me think of a video we recently watched of Peter Liljedahl talking about visibly random groups. And he was commenting on this fact that when you do visibly random groups, sometimes you end up with a homogeneous group, because that's the crazy thing around randomness. And he says that, you know, when they were doing all this research around it, and it would happen, you know, that maybe your three strongest math students end up in a group together, teachers would remark to him and say, like, watch that group over there. Like, they are really going to do something. And that every single time, the seemingly weaker students that had diversity of thought always did better than homogeneous groups. And he remarks that diversity is really a strength in mathematics, and we don't always recognize that. And so I really think this is what the author is getting at, as well as, you know, Paulo Tan back with when we read his book, Humanism and Disabilities in Mathematics. Mm-hmm. Like, can we just imagine what we could be discovering in the field of mathematics, what we could be learning in the field of mathematics, if we actually believe that everyone can do math?
Yeah. Audrey, I'm just sitting with that for a second, just thinking about the amount of minds that could be part of solving some of the world's most interesting problems that have to do with mathematics, and how if we exclude them somewhere in their schooling, that we're missing out on those great minds. And, you know, the thing that's also interesting, Audrey, is that how this cycle that we're in, it perpetuates itself. The author brings out that idea of brilliance. Mm-hmm. And something that resonated with me is that there's a certain amount of mathematicians value brilliance, even though it's something that cannot be taught. So that what's considered brilliance is this thing that's more of an innate trait. And if that's being perpetuated, like at the university level, right? And thinking about if it's perpetuating at earlier levels as well, again, back to those creative minds that we're missing out on in the field of mathematics. A quote that resonated with me, Audrey, is on page 22. And it says this: if we believe brilliance is necessary for success in mathematics, that brilliance is limited to few. And that brilliance cannot be taught. It is difficult to imagine a reality where many decide to study mathematics in our society. The other way, I know I've said it before, Audrey, is that we are giving bad advertising to mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
We are not showing our students that creativity, that part of mathematics that would draw them in to be those future problem solvers that we need.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I think it's a great point, Mark. I think, you know, she starts essentially by offering all the things that we perpetuate in society. And you've brought up a couple points there as well around the idea of brilliance. That's the broken part around it, right? So I'm super curious around thinking then around like, okay, if that's not what it is, if that's not
right
equal to what being good at math is, what does it mean to be good at math? Or is that phrase broken in and of itself, you know? And so she offers this idea around persistence, and the quote I underlined and kind of feel like might be her kind of thesis on that is that struggle in mathematics is to be expected. And those who are successful are not those who do not encounter struggle, but those who persist despite it.
Yeah, that's a great quote, Audrey. And it also does remind me, though, that the phrase productive struggle and the word struggle is one of those phrases that is what I call suffering from overuse in the sense that it starts to split and it means so many different things to so many different people. Kind of like years ago, the same thing happened to the word rigor, where it just suffered this similar fate. I want to go back to that idea of this cycle of that we're reproducing around struggle. You know, we've really retreaded this in so many ways as educators. We've either smoothed over a problem so smoothly to reduce the struggle, to protect our students from having to feel like they're stuck, and ensure our good instruction allows it to never happen in the first place. You know, I used to think about like, how would I have thought that a math lesson went so well? Well, it's went so well because everybody got it, whatever that means, right? They got it the first time. And, you know, having students be able to take a problem, push it aside, and thinking about it a new way and coming back to it over and over is so different than that idea of us thinking about success, meaning I said something and everybody got it, whatever that means, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and she remarks that too few people have ever had this opportunity to work on an open-ended problem, make mathematical discoveries, build mathematics for themselves. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about, Mark, is like, we don't provide this opportunity for students to do these things and really explore mathematics in that way.
Yeah, I think that this all really connects to this idea of creativity, that creativity in the book on page 12, the author has this great quote around creativity. Mathematicians do not work on problems that have a set of steps previously laid out for them. So there is a need for creativity and approaching problems in multiple ways. So that idea that creativity is actually needed, it's required, but when it's the other way of who gets it right away, that there's no space for creativity, right, Audrey? There's just like, it's not even like valued. It's like, just do it.
Yeah. Yeah. She even mentioned like the amount of space that we allow in problems when we pass out papers to our students. And you're making me think of that, Mark, like if I give you an inch of the paper to be as creative as you can, that's not much room, right?
right.
We kind of set ourselves up for it. So, you know, and another way we set ourselves up for it, I think, is that, you know, we often put these non-routine rich tasks, as you're talking about them, after you've slogged through your set of very mundane, not so rich tasks, right?
Yeah, right.
And she really points out, the author points out that you know, the opposite is really true. Some students in particular need the rich mathematical tasks first in order for them to then engage in those mundane things, that they need to see the why. They need to understand why do I need to learn this formula? Why do I need to learn an algorithm? And I just appreciate, you know, this idea of starting with the why. I think that Simon Sinek's work is true in mathematics too. Like math isn't outside of that grasp. Like some folks in particular need the why before they can make sense of all of the necessary pieces attached to it. So I appreciate her little take on that too.
Yeah, that's a great point. The other thing that I noticed in the chapter, Audrey, that definitely got my attention in this section is just this idea of getting lost in mathematics. And as you know, I taught elementary school for a while, and I really identified with the phrase of students getting lost in a book. I mean, I use that phrase in my classroom. I don't know that I always used the phrase getting lost in mathematics, because I think that probably took on a negative tone. If you're lost in mathematics, that probably meant like you needed a lot of help. But that's not what the author means here, right? Getting lost in mathematics. I mean, what we're talking about there is getting lost in the problem where you're considering many options. You're considering these different ways of solving the problem. It's like a puzzle to figure out. And a quote comes to mind when I was working on my master's program. There was this quote, and it went something like this. And it said that children think that there is a big answer book somewhere, and it has all the answers to all the math problems that they need. And if they could just get their hands on that big book, then everything would be okay, because they could just use that big book to just put all the answers in that they need. And Audrey, as I was reading this chapter, it made me think back to that quote, and really also made me start thinking back to this whole idea of answer keys in mathematics. I mean, of all the content areas, I think mathematics has a strong draw toward the answer key. And I really just started to wonder a little bit about how that idea of having an answer key for students, for teachers, and what that does to how we view mathematics.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Mark. You know, there's two connections that are recent in the news that I'm making to what you're talking about. One is that recently two New Orleans high school students, high school seniors, have come up with a proof for Pythagorean theorem using trigonometry, which apparently academics have said for nearly 2,000 years was impossible. And like, so one of the aspects I kind of hear you saying is like this, what would it look like to think of it as a puzzle? And is there another way to solve it, right? And so sometimes I think when we say even the phrase like, could you solve it another way? You know, is there another way you could solve it? We forget again the why to that. Like, is it because it's curious and you think there's more than one way, or that's the only way, right? Or are you just making me do mindless work, right?
Compliance, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the second example, she was describing in this chapter how like sometimes math has starts and stops, and you might have to like approach one way and then realize, oh no, I got to approach the problem a different way. And I think this is what you're describing here too. Recently, again, some researchers found a problem that was like 10, 20 years old that people had not been able to solve. And they figured it out. They figured out this tile piece, and we'll leave it in the show notes. It's called a hat polykite, which is just super interesting. Mm-hmm. It can tile the whole plane, but it does in a non-repeating way. Like you could never find a repetition to it. And they didn't think that was possible either, right? And you know, when you read the paper about their journey, there were lots of starts and stops. There were lots of abandoning something and trying something else. And so like, it isn't about this big book of answers somewhere. It is about discovery. It is about seeing it a different way. It's about making the way you see it your own. It is right so much more creative, like you're describing, than it is about a compliance or fitting the square peg in the square hole, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it makes me think of the phrase like a question, is math alive or is it dead?
Yeah. That's a great point.
Yeah, it comes to mind.
We've talked a little bit about things that have resonated with us or kind of fit in with our thinking or things that were interesting so far in the chapter. I'm curious if there's things that maybe there's dissonance for you in the chapter.
Yeah, you know, as I was looking on page 24, there's an inset there that's the header is to explore what it means to be good at mathematics in the classroom. And Audrey, as I was going through those bullets, I found the last one to be the most impactful for me. The last one says, give students the opportunity to revise their work, highlighting that which matters is learning over time. And I think the revision and students being able to continue to revise their work based on new learning, I think that's a really powerful point. I really appreciated that. I didn't make as many connections with the other bullets, but I did start thinking about, you know, if I had to put a bullet here, Audrey, I wonder what a bullet would be that I think would be something that describes what it would be a support to students to be able to see how they might be good at mathematics in the classroom. And one of the things that I went back to was actually on page 31 in the chapter. And in page 31, the author has this great section around feedback and praise, and really giving us some cautions around that, which I think were just right on. And one of the things I thought about that I think is an important takeaway in terms of having kids feel like that they're good at math, if we want to use that phrase. Earlier, of course, we said to ourselves, we're not sure about that phrase, good at math, because it could mean a lot of things, but I'm going to stick with it for a minute here. So the phrase good at math is when we're thinking about interacting with students around their ideas and they're sharing their ideas in class, is considering how much validation we give to certain ideas and whether we need to make sure that we're not giving validation or correctness or redirection around what we can might perceive as incorrect ideas. When we're in a classroom discussion and students offer a particular idea, I think part of being good at math is being able to be knowing that I'm in a safe place that I can share that idea. I can pitch this idea to my fellow students. They can give me some feedback around that idea, and we can continue thinking together about whatever puzzle we're trying to figure out. So I think a very important part about being good at math is for us as educators to create this environment where students have that ability to share ideas without getting feedback around correct or incorrect, and allowing the class to have that discussion around that. And having that to take place in that way.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mark. I appreciate you even pointing out this insert or that kind of those bullet points, because I think we communicate what we believe in our classrooms in so many ways, most of which I think are probably beyond our consciousness that we're even doing it. And again, Peter Liljedahl's work was centered around that in terms of how do we communicate to students that we want them to think in class. And they had to peel back so many layers to realize it was a lot of things that communicated to students that we expected them not to think. And the things that communicate to think are not necessarily just us saying, please think, or I want you to think about this task, but it's all these other things you might not, realize you're communicating with. And so I'm thinking about that in this context of here is that our assessment practices communicate what we think it means to be good at math. Like if we give a test and we expect you to get it right, and there's right or wrong answers, and we expect you to do it our way, that's communicating something. If we're driven by a pacing guide to complete things both in a certain timeline and in a certain sequence that was predetermined maybe even before I met my students, that communicates something about what we believe to be good at mathematics. And it will continue to favor certain students being, good and other students not, right? And so how do we unpack those and think about those so that it's more than just a poster on the wall that says, I like mistakes or mistakes are welcome in my class, right? Because I've seen those everywhere. And yet you talk to the students about the culture, they're like, well, not really, because she just marked me down on my test, right? Like the mistake was not valued when it was test day. The mistake was not valued on quiz day. It wasn't, hey, good job, you made a mistake today. It was, yeah, whoops, yeah, you lost some points. So I'm super curious about how we continue to maybe interrogate that in our own classes and in our own spaces and say, what are the things that I do that are communicating to my students that being good at mathematics isn't speed, an ability to use formulas and ability, right? But instead, this ability to persist, this ability to think, right? All of those other spaces. So thanks for bringing that up. There was another space for me that had a little bit of dissonance. And I have to start by just saying, like, I really appreciate this idea of uncovering our own biases. Like, that is, we've talked about that in many, many of our seasons.
Oh, yeah.
One of the sets of authors that are highlighted here are Beth Cobit and Karen Karp. And they're quoted as saying, like, the first step in changing the narrative is to consciously hear the language we use to describe our students. And they share figure 1.4 on all these ideas around, like, the words we might have said, we might have heard, and maybe the underlying belief, and then an alternate belief. And a lot of these were just, like, wonderful for me to read and say, like, yes, we need to think about that. When we hear that, when we say that, this is the belief that's inside of that, and how do we think of an alternative? But there were a couple that didn't sit well with me that I kind of wanted to push. Like, if I was sitting in a conversation with the author, Lydia, or if I was sitting with Beth or Karen, like, I'd want to, like, push on. So, like, I'll just bring them up into this space. One of the lines says, the statement is, if you've ever said, even though he's motivated to learn, he's unable to retain the concepts, which might have this underlying belief that students who struggle with retention cannot learn mathematics. But the alternative belief is still about retaining knowledge. It's like, oh, this person retains more when they're with their peers, so let's pair them with someone. And I really, like, I would just want to push on that and say, if we're going to think about this idea that students who struggle with retention cannot learn mathematics, for me, the antithesis of that is that students who struggle with retention can learn mathematics, right? Yeah. Retention is not mathematics. It's retention. It's something different. And so, like, the opposite of that, or the alternative belief, would be something along the lines of, well, what does the student know? And what are they capable of doing when we allow them choice in what tools they use? Like, how are they an expert learner, to use a phrase from our Universal Design for Learning book study? Like, how, right? Like, all of those pieces, that it's not about holding specific knowledge in your brain, but it's about what you're doing with the knowledge that you surround yourself with. So I'd push on that one. You can shoot me down later. The other one is right below it, where it says, he can do this, he's just lazy, which has a belief of students choose not to work. And it says the alternative belief is, well, we need to find out why he did not complete his work, which is totally fair. I think asking students, interviewing students, finding that out is a fair thing to do. But I think that still centers that completing the work matters, right? Like, we're asking the students why they didn't complete it, because I want you to complete it. What would it look like if we really believed that mathematics is not about finishing, right? Like, she describes earlier in the chapter several times, like, mathematicians don't always finish their problems. Sometimes it takes weeks, years, sometimes they walk away from it. And so what would it look like if we held that belief? What would our alternative be when a student does not choose to do the work, right? Maybe we need to ask, what's an alternative way they can show us what they do know? Like, is the question, you know, do you see what I'm saying, Mark?
Yeah,
like, I'm struggling
yeah,
with, like,
yeah,
it can't be about work completion. It has to be about doing and thinking mathematically. It can't be about the thing. So I'm kind of wrestling with, how do we phrase that alternative belief in a way that really promotes what we've been talking about communicating in our classes, about what we really believe mathematics is?
Yeah, I, Audrey, I think you really hit upon something important with this idea of finishing work. My head went right even to homework, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like the kitchen table battle with parents and kids, you know, we got to finish our math homework. And I think that phrase is used more than any other content area, right?
Nightly in my house. Yes. Yes.
So what is that about the way mathematics has been done in schooling traditionally, that is about finishing some degree of completeness? And what messages, as you just so well put, are we sending when it's always about completing something? And if it's not complete, there's automatically a consequence or a negative view around that. Even if there's still some learning that's still going on in that, there's still something about going back to school and having a paper that's not complete, even if there was an attempt, even if the teacher is sympathetic, there's something less about that, about it, how it's viewed. So Audrey, I really appreciate you giving us some space to think about that.
Yeah. Super curious to see, maybe think about that some more. But maybe we can pivot for a moment before we run out of time this episode.
Sure.
What are the connections you're making between this chapter and the work that we do in terms of leading mathematics, working with teacher leaders, working with teachers? Anything strike you as interesting?
Yeah, for sure, Audrey. Lots of things. I'll keep it to one for time's sake. One of the things that I'm thinking in terms of our professional leading of teachers and really trying to support them in leading mathematics at their schools is trying to think about how they might be able to share. Well, actually, let me go back. I'm going to just read the quote, Audrey, because I think it'll set the stage a little bit better. There's a quote on page 30. And our author sets this up really nicely, much better than I can, so I'm going to go ahead and read it. Perhaps they, and she's referring to mathematicians, prove a particular theorem in some way. Then they consider finding a more elegant proof, one that uses fewer steps, perhaps if more direct or more efficient in that way, is a matter of aesthetics. And that was on page 30. And you know, how I really see how this can support me in supporting teachers, Audrey, is when we're thinking about how students might solve problems in different ways, and you brought this up earlier, we sometimes get into this habit of just saying another way, like why another way, how another way? And something about that quote that hit me was that idea of an elegant proof. So the way that a student might change their solution strategy or how they've solved the problem might be just in how they're communicating that particular solution to a classmate or to another audience. And so I think that we sometimes, again, for the sake of efficiency in grabbing an idea in education and saying, this is about doing lots of different ways to solve problems, we've lost the forest through the trees, right? Like we lost the point of like, this is about being a mathematician, and a mathematician would have a variety of reasons to show another way or another view into their thinking. And so that's something that really is staying with me, Audrey, from this chapter. And I really see that informing me as I go to work in the schools and places that I work.
I love that. Thanks for that, Mark. I was checking out the reflection questions in the study guide that attaches to this book. And one of them was, what ways do the activities you use with teachers promote the idea that to be good at math is to persist through problems? And I thought that was a super interesting question, because people who worked with Mark or I, or the two of us together, in person or in virtual settings, know that like we love to start our work with math tasks, right? Like we are always like, let's do a math problem. And one thing I don't think is I don't think I always make super transparent is how intentional we are about the problem we pick and why we pick it. I know we don't say it aloud a lot of times because that would be, it would change the participant's experience, right? If you were like, I'm picking this so that you really feel productive struggle today. Like that would totally, that would ruin it. But just as it's so critical that teachers spend time choosing worthy math tasks that are for their students, we as leaders of teachers need to take that much time and consideration when we put tasks in front of teachers. I think it's really easy to say, I'm just going to grab this problem, or I saw someone else do this problem, let's put it in front of them. And I think there needs to be more thought to that about why. What are you trying to gain with this math task? And so in some of the ones we do where they're pretty open-ended, the discomfort with productive struggle is real. Like we've had, adults become really uncomfortable with what's the answer and where's the big book up in the sky that has all the answers to this.
Right.
We toy a lot with tasks that don't have a neat ending or that the ending is left hanging when we move on to other things. But what I've never done is I've never actually given a problem that doesn't have, you know where I'm heading with this,
I
huh?
know where you're
That
going.
doesn't have a known answer, right? Like when she described these problems in here that are like, there's a space where you can look up good problems that don't have answers. I was like, I've never tried that. Like, what would that feel like if our room, do you know what I'm saying? Like, if none of us had any better access to solving the problem than anyone else, like, does that level the playing field? Does that, how does that feel if we know there's no answer? And how can we then translate that into the kinds of experiences we give our kids so that they're doing math that isn't answered, that's authentically a math question? Like, we don't know. Like, we don't know the answer. I can't flip in my teacher book and find it, or I can't tell you you're correct. I don't know. So I'm holding on to that and thinking about that and might toy with that the next time. So, friends, when you show up next time to one of our things,
Well,
watch out. We might just do an open
and I'm
problem.
super curious whether you're going to tell them before you leave or not. That's the main question I have for that, Audrey. Super curious. Great. Well, thanks for joining us for this episode. In our next episode, we will chat about Chapter 2, Beyond Numbers and Equations, What is Mathematics? And continue to discuss how we dismantle harmful beliefs that hinder equitable mathematics in education. Until then, best wishes on rewriting the story of math.